I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
British military officials now say that six Royal Military Police killed in southern Iraq yesterday died after Iraqis became angry when soldiers conducting home searches entered women's rooms. A spontaneous eruption of violence, seemingly in this case. But a second ambush of British troops in the same previously calm area of southern Iraq, which injured at least eight, seems to have been a highly organized, coordinated attack. Joining us on the line now from London to sort out the latest on this is Michael Evans. He's defense editor for The Times of London. Welcome, Michael.
Hi.
Michael, what's the latest you have about these attacks? There were two in or around the village of Majar al-Kabir, which is about 15 miles south of the southern city of Amara, a previously calm area.
There's still a degree of confusion. I think what is clear at the moment is that the more serious incident when six soldiers were killed was probably a sort of boiling over point between the local Iraqis and the British troops. There have been a lot of searches of houses recently there for arms and explosives and whatever, and I think the searches had caused some resentment. Now, the other incident, though, there does appear to be much more of a coordinated attack. I mean, a helicopter was attacked, two Land Rovers were attacked, they used heavy machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. This doesn't sound to me like a spontaneous move. This sounds to me like something that was more planned. So the two incidents were linked in the sense that they took part in the same place and on the same day, but I don't think each was coordinated in other ways.
Now, Major General Peter Walls, commander of the 1st UK Armored Division, he's called for a risk assessment. Now, the British soldiers for many, many weeks now, as you know, have been going around in southern Iraq without flak vests, without helmets. They've been wearing their berets. They've been lightly armed. Could that risk assessment by the Major General change that?
I don't think it will. I'm sure that in this particular area where they've had these incidents, every time any patrol goes out, they're going to take a very, very close look at what the risks are on that particular day. And if it's decided that the risks are high, then, of course, they'll wear helmets and flak jackets.
What about bringing in more British troops?
No, I don't think that'll happen either. I think this is one of these sort of early initial responses, you know, oh, my goodness, there's been a terrible incident, send for more troops. But I don't think it'll happen. I think that General Wall probably feels that there are sufficient numbers of troops in the area and that it won't be required to send reinforcements.
Now, if the attack, particularly that attack on the paratroop unit, was coordinated, what would that signify?
It's very difficult to tell. This is a Shiite area. It's not a Sunni area, so you wouldn't expect a lot of former Ba'athist either militia or members to be around in that area, but clearly there are some. I think it's a little worrying that if it is coordinated to that extent, then clearly someone somewhere has decided that it's time to start stirring it up in the south, and I think that would pose considerable problems for the British troops, and it is alarming.
Finally, Michael, we hear of British forces giving Iraqis a 48-hour ultimatum to turn in people responsible for these attacks. Where does that all stand, and what happens if the ultimatum is not met?
Yeah, I'm afraid when you have major incidents like this, you tend to get all kinds of reports coming in all directions. I'm absolutely assured that that 48-hour ultimatum is not correct. There has not been an ultimatum. I think what they have decided is to suspend these searches for a couple of months just to sort of keep the tension down, and then they'll probably reassess what sort of searches and how they should do them in the future.
Well, Michael Evans, thanks for clarifying that, and thanks for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
Michael Evans is defense editor for The Times of London.
British Member of Parliament George Galloway says he will sue the Christian Science Monitor. In April, the Christian Science Monitor and, separately, two British papers claimed to have found Iraqi government documents showing Galloway was paid to further Iraq's interests in the West. This past week, the Monitor retracted their story, saying they now know the documents they found are forgeries. Well, Galloway, who was suspended from the Labour Party in May for comments critical of Prime Minister Blair and President Bush, says he doesn't accept the apology. The Christian Science Monitor declined to speak with us, but we are joined by Mr. Galloway. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, your first thoughts.
Well, I don't accept the apology. Of course, this is one of the world's great newspapers. It published in more than 90 countries around the world the utterly false allegation that I had taken $10 million from the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. They didn't even make a telephone call to me to ask me if it was true. They didn't do any checks as to the authenticity of the documents which they were happy to emblazon on the front page of their newspaper. And now that they have done these checks and found them to be forgeries, they want me to accept a simple sorry as an explanation. Well, I don't.
Well, the Monitor does say in their article of June 20th that their reporter, Philip Smucker, was given the papers written in Arabic by an Iraqi general who said he found them in Saddam's son's house. Another British paper, The Mail on Sunday, raised suspicions about that general, and the Monitor had the papers checked by Iraqi and forgery experts. But, Mr. Galloway, the headline in yet another British paper, The Daily Telegraph in London, the day after the Monitor mea culpa, is, "No, Mr. Galloway, you're not in the clear yet." They say that their documents, found completely separately from the Monitor documents, are real.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? They're facing exactly the same problem that the Christian Science Monitor is, that they published to the world a set of lies about me, a pack of lies, which are absolutely fake.
But according to the Christian Science Monitor, in their research where they went to all of these specialists, those specialists who condemned the Monitor documents also said that they believed that the Daily Telegraph documents were real.
Well, they didn't, and you should be a bit more careful about what you're saying. They said that the documents were not the same as the documents in the Christian Science Monitor.
Well, you're absolutely right. The direct quote from the Monitor is, "After examining copies of two pages of the Daily Telegraph's documents linking Galloway with the Hussein regime, the expert pronounced them consistent, unlike the Monitor counterparts, with authentic Iraqi documents he has seen."
Well, that's
that doesn't say that they are real.
That the allegations in the documents are true, and I'm telling you that they're lies.
Well, Mr. Galloway, let me ask you this. Why would a general in Iraq want to, as somebody has apparently, forge documents to indict you and to say that you had this relationship with the Hussein regime? Why would they want to do that?
I really don't think there's any question that there's a conspiracy. There's more than one person involved. It wasn't all cooked up in the back shop by a superannuated general with a spare few hours and a bottle of ink and a quill. It's a very much more sophisticated operation than that. Mm. And I want to get to the bottom of it.
You have acknowledged, I mean, there's no question, you have been in Iraq. Are you saying that, when you say conspiracy, are you saying that potentially people in Iraq who did not support the Hussein regime, Iraqis themselves, might have a grudge against you? Or are you saying that some British forces might be fomenting this?
Well, I'm not in a position to say. I can't even make a telephone call to Iraq, but I hope you'll acknowledge that I became one of the leaders of the worldwide movement against sanctions and war on Iraq. That made me a lot of enemies, not least because for 30 years I've been one of the leading figures fighting for Palestinian rights here in Britain and around the Middle East. So I'm not short of enemies with the wherewithal and the motive to try and wipe me out of politics.
Mm. And so you say now you plan to sue. This would be a dangerous tack to take if it brought in the other documents from the other papers. In other words, you firmly believe that those other documents as well are not real.
They're all fake. We've already unmasked two out of the three of them in just a few weeks. And the third will soon bite the dust. They're all fakes, and they're all being sued.
Well, Mr. Galloway, I have a feeling we'll be speaking with you again.
I hope so.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
British MP George Galloway, who is suing the Christian Science Monitor, which this week apologized for printing false information about his relationship with the Saddam Hussein government.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is widely expected to cut interest rates today again to stimulate the still uncertain economy and hold off possible deflation. Interest rate cuts are generally good for stock prices and people with mortgages, but they're bad for people who depend on savings accounts, certificates of deposit, and money market funds. Some $2 trillion of our economy is tied up in money market funds, and with interest rates at historic lows, those funds aren't making much money and could even start going backwards, losing money for investors. Rachel Barnard is a stock analyst with Morningstar, a global investment research firm based in Chicago. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
To get started, let's remind ourselves and remind me, what is exactly a money market fund?
A money market fund is a fund basically what people use to stash their cash in. A lot of people use it like a bank account or a CD to stash their cash short term. And it typically returns fairly small amount of interest. And it's also typically fairly safe.
So as interest rates have been falling, how has that affected money market funds?
Well, money market funds typically track the interest rate or the Fed funds rate that we've been talking about. So as that goes down, the interest that people get on their money market funds goes down as well.
We mentioned in our introduction these accounts could even start going backwards?
Well, that's true, although I think that's really unlikely. But the reason people think that or are worried about that is that with the federal funds rate going lower and lower and lower, money market fund providers, mutual fund companies and the like, actually have to cover their expenses somehow. And they do that by charging a percent of the assets in money market funds. And when the expenses start equaling the interest rate on money market funds, all of a sudden they aren't profitable to provide.
So when do we know whether these funds could get to a point where it's just not worth being in them?
Well, they're actually getting really close right now. The average interest rate on a money market fund is 0.68%. So that's 68 cents on your $100. And if, you know, the fees are getting about 60 cents, then there's very little left over that the funds can profitably pay out to you.
So what happens then? Do people start to pull out, or do the money market funds themselves just decide, don't bother?
Yeah, good question. There's been a lot of speculation about that. One thing that could happen is that they'll just give the money back to their investors and say, you know, here you go, we can't do this profitably, put your money somewhere else. Another thing that could happen is some of the less profitable money market providers could sell out to bigger operations who have a lot more scale and can do it for a lower cost.
How likely do you think is this dark scenario for money market funds?
Well, it's not as dark as it looks for most funds. Even with a 50 basis point cut, which is the maximum people are expecting, only about 9% of fund assets of that $2 trillion you mentioned, only about 9% of that will actually be unprofitable to run. So it's not a huge percentage of the industry, but it's certainly not a small number.
So irregardless, money markets are going to remain a fairly thriving part of the economy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people need these kind of products, not only you and me, but also institutions. So what would typically happen is that the ones who wanted to stay in the business, which will probably be most of them, will just start eating the fees and basically running unprofitable funds so that they can give their investors some interest, even if it's just a small bit. And they'll be hoping for better times and hoping that rates go up when the economy recovers.
Rachel Barnard, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, you're welcome.
Rachel Barnard is a stock analyst with the global investment research firm Morningstar Incorporated in Chicago.
Just ahead, never, 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 never give in. So said Winston Churchill. We'll talk with his granddaughter.
And later in the show, what state budget cuts mean for community colleges.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
In November, Britons voted Winston Churchill the greatest Briton of all time. Rudolph Giuliani says he's sought the words of Churchill for inspiration. I myself have this quote posted on the fridge: success is going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm. Well, now in a new book, Winston Churchill's granddaughter, Celia Sandys, looks at the lessons we can all learn from Winston Churchill. The book is called We Shall Not Fail, The Inspiring Leadership of Winston Churchill. And Celia Sandys joins us on the line from London, England. Hello and welcome.
Well, nice to be with you.
To remind us how close you are to the subject, in the introduction to the book, there's an anecdote. Were you the only one present when Winston Churchill watched the news of the assassination of JFK on television?
Yes, I was. I was spending the evening with him. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredible event. And I mean, my grandfather was never ashamed to shed a tear. And I assure you, he shed many tears on that evening.
Yeah. Being able to show his emotions is one of the qualities you mention throughout the course of the book. And sometimes those took the form of anger.
Yes, for instance, when he was getting really irritated with Stalin, he slammed his fist on the table and was absolutely furious. And Stalin didn't wait for the interpreter to interpret. He said, "I don't understand a word you're saying, but by God, I like your tone."
Many are familiar with the remarks and the tone of Winston Churchill during World War II, especially in the lead up to war, where he went against those in Britain who would appease Hitler. Did he write his speeches?
Oh, yes, he did. He had people who would help him with a lot of research, and he called in a lot of information, but the speech was always his own.
Mm. And they're so extraordinary. I mean, everyone can pick a phrase out of the air. His never in the field of human conflict speech, never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. All hearts go out to the fighter pilots. You've written your book with author Jonathan Littman about how these words might be used in business and by business leaders today. But how do you feel about how they're being used by other leaders today?
Well, it's been extraordinary, really. Since September the 11th, there's been the most extraordinary revival of Churchillian speeches. Not necessarily the precise words, but very much a Churchillian ring to the speeches of President Bush, Tony Blair, and definitely, of course, the references made by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, and who wrote to me and said, your grandfather was a great source of strength and inspiration to me.
Mm. But, there were some who would wince at the thought of, let's say, a George Bush using the, you know, never give in to terror phrases and apply it to Iraq.
I don't see why anyone should wince at that. I think that one thing is if the war that was being waged was one which certainly George Bush and Tony Blair, they were pursuing principles which they believed in. They certainly weren't pursuing these to make themselves popular, particularly not, I mean, Tony Blair, he was completely vilified here, but he pursued it because he believed he was doing the right thing. Mm. In the same way that my grandfather, when he was trying to tell everyone for 10 long years in the 30s what was going to come, and no one would listen.
Well, and there is another lesson that they would take from Churchill, from your grandfather as well. You say he was vilified in the 30s when he was pushing against the appeasers. He won the war and was summarily booted out of office.
Well, that's right. And he was very distraught at the time and felt that it was a huge act of ungratitude by the people. But at the same time, my grandmother said to him, "Well, Winston, this may turn out to be a blessing in disguise." And he said, "If so, it's very effectively disguised."
Hmm. And Churchill did go back into office 6 years later.
Yes, he did, yes.
There's so many anecdotes in the book, the times that Winston Churchill went to the front, that his was the first government to have a war room, which he slept close to and often came to visit in his silk bathrobe. And a time that I bet he wished he had a bathrobe, right after Pearl Harbor. The U.S. acknowledged that, in fact, we are all in the same boat now, was President Roosevelt's words to Churchill. And Roosevelt came to visit Churchill, who was taking the bath and dictating to his secretary. And
that's right.
As you write, in the commotion to greet the president, Churchill's towel fell to the floor. The door opened to a surprised Roosevelt, leading Churchill to famously, and you say, and truly declaim, "As you can see, Mr. President, I have nothing to hide from you." Is that true?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I was told it by the man who was with him, who he was dictating to, Patrick Kinner, his secretary.
And as you write, the lesson there, seize the opportunity. Well, Celia, you share some personal anecdotes as well. I'm looking at one when you were a small child and your grandfather sent you a little bulldog that someone had given him, and your mother His daughter explained that that's because he was thought of as the bulldog, so you went to school.
And I went round and I said, and I asked them in turn, I said, what sort of dog is your grandfather? Mine's a bulldog.
Do you have another moment to share with us?
On one occasion, he fell in his room in the Hotel de Paris in Monte Carlo, and he broke his hip. And he told his private secretary, I don't want to die in France. I want to die in England. And he was 88 years old, and it was clearly quite possible he would die. And the Prime Minister of England, Harold Macmillan, sent an RAF ambulance plane out to get him. And the incredible thing was we came out of the airplane and he was so fragile, so vulnerable. There were a whole lot of workers from the airport who'd gathered to greet him. And he came down in the stretcher and he looked at them, smiled and gave them a V sign and they all clapped. And it was incredible the strength he took to do that and the amount of pleasure it gave to them. And it gave him, as it were, an injection of energy, the very fact that he'd done it. It was an extraordinary, moving moment.
Mm. Well, Celia Sandys, thank you for the book.
Well, thank you for interviewing me. Nice to be on your program.
Celia Sandys, granddaughter of Winston Churchill. And now a brief excerpt from Churchill's 1940 speech before the House of Commons, urging Britons to stand up against the approaching Hitler.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for a thousand years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're Indonesian soldiers behind a fatal attack on some American teachers there. We'll talk with a reporter who's following the investigation.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, minority college students may be more affected by state budget cuts than this week's Supreme Court decision on affirmative action.
And the side effects of the Supreme Court decision allowing software that filters out pornography on library computers, that software might block a whole lot more.
You know, the Supreme Court has essentially said that my medical information site is okay to block. They understood that these blocking filters really are not that good, and they understood that there really was a number of legitimate sites that are blocked.
These stories and summer salads coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Three Palestinian groups have agreed to halt attacks on Israelis for 90 days. An official with Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement says his group, along with Hamas and Islamic Jihad, will make a formal announcement on the truce later today. Israel is greeting the statement with some skepticism. A spokesman for Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says no formal announcement has been made by the Palestinians. The man who will succeed General Tommy Franks as commander of U.S. forces in Iraq says he's confident weapons of mass destruction will eventually be found there. However, Lieutenant General John Abizaid tells the Senate Armed Services Committee that intelligence was, quote, incomplete on the strategic level with regard to WMDs.
It is perplexing to me, Senator, that we have not found weapons of mass destruction when the evidence was so pervasive that it would exist.
Abizaid also says the number of U.S. troops in Iraq will be evaluated at the end of the month. The Federal Reserve is expected to lower interest rates today for the 13th time since 2001 in an effort to stimulate the sluggish economy. Prudential Securities market analyst Larry Wachtel says he doesn't think the move will have much effect on the stock market.
The market is operating right now under the aegis of this enormous move that's taken place over the last 3.5 months. It's tired. It's overbought. It has to settle down. I can't believe anything that comes out of the Fed today will revitalize it and send it soaring higher.
Meanwhile, the housing market continues to benefit from low mortgage interest rates. The Commerce Department says sales of new single-family homes soared 12.5% in May to the highest level on record. Federal energy regulators have barred Enron from selling electricity and natural gas at market rates anywhere in the U.S. The Houston-based company will be able to sell power, but at much less competitive prices until it emerges from bankruptcy proceedings and gets regulatory approval. Enron went bankrupt 2 years ago after a series of revelations of hidden debt, inflated profits, and questionable accounting. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 29 points at 91.39, and the NASDAQ is up 19 at 16.25, the S&P 500 up 6. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It's being called the silent killer of a minority enrollment in higher education. And it has nothing to do with affirmative action, the subject we've heard so much about this week following those important Supreme Court decisions. Those who study higher education say that plummeting state investment in community colleges is the biggest threat to minority students receiving a college diploma. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, 20,000 black and Hispanic students in California alone will be shut out of that state's community colleges this year because of budget cuts. Well, joining us to discuss the issue is Travis Rendell, Director of State Policy at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Welcome, Travis.
Bill, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Nearly half of the country's 3 million black and Hispanic college students attend community colleges. What's the effect of budget cuts on this population?
Well, I think that the effect could be very devastating, particularly the longer this budget crisis grinds on, simply because those programs at community colleges that tend to be the most vulnerable, and at public four-year colleges that often are the most vulnerable, are those that really help to ensure success for those disadvantaged students. We're talking about outreach programs, English as a second language programs, and as well as just basic academic offerings that are going to be enrollment limited simply because there isn't enough money to go around. And so this is a very serious issue, not just in California, but nationwide.
Now, California's bracing for a 5.6% cut. Maryland might slash up to 25%. Texas is reducing its community college budget by 12%. But is anybody seeing these cuts as a minority issue?
I think there is an increasing awareness of what the real effect of this sort of cutback will be. There is still just a growing amount of recognition, I think, in the policymaker world that looking ahead 5 to 10 years, the bulk of our growth is going to be in minority populations in higher education, particularly in public higher education, and that those cuts are going to really challenge our ability to provide access to those students that have historically been in groups that haven't been as well represented.
Now, the Supreme Court, as we alluded to in our introduction this week, historically upheld affirmative action as a way to bring students into a university. But how much does that matter in the community college world?
The impact of the Grotz and Grutter decisions doesn't reach extensively down to the community college and the what I would call the open access four-year institution levels. It is more a concern for those more selective universities. I think it's not an either-or situation in terms of really emphasizing for access. It's a both-and. But I think that now we've seen a great deal of attention focused on the Supreme Court, and now that they've provided their roadmap, I think it's time to really buckle down and focus on the budgetary implications that we're seeing in the states and focus on that aspect angle, which I think is equally, if not more, compelling.
Well, Travis, thanks for helping us bring that focus.
Absolutely.
Travis Rendell, Director of State Policy at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
This week's Supreme Court decision that Congress can require libraries to filter pornography from computers in order to receive federal funds has many web-based companies concerned. Filtering software can protect kids from pornography, but it can also block medical sites that discuss breast cancer or sites which contain the letter X, Super Bowl sites, for instance, or the University of California Mathematics Archive, because they spell archive with an X. Then there's a site called afraidtoask.com. Joining us on the line now is Dr. John Burtman. He runs the site, and welcome.
Hi.
Well, what is afraidtoask.com?
Well, afraidtoask.com is a medical website that deals with highly personal topics, such as the ones you've mentioned, as well as bowels, skin cancer, sexually transmitted diseases.
It answers people's questions about breast cancer you were alluding to. Not mathematics, right?
No, not mathematics.
So what kind of clients come to the website?
25% of our users are under 18 years of age, and another 25% are between 18 and 24. And we get about nearly a million visitors a month.
Well, the Children's Internet Protection Act was the target of the suit by the ACLU, the American Library Association, and your company was also one of the plaintiffs. What are your fears about what the Supreme Court has decided?
You know, the Supreme Court has essentially said that my medical information site is okay to block. They understood that these blocking filters really are not that good, and they understood that they're really with a number of legitimate sites that are blocked.
As you also know, kids whose parents come into the library and give permission, they can remove the block, and any adult can ask for a computer without the block. So some people would say, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that specifically with medical information on highly personal topics, if your 17-year-old or 16-year-old daughter has a rash and is concerned this could be herpes or is thinking of becoming sexually active and wants to learn about the risks of that, they are going to feel uncomfortable asking their parent to tell the librarian to unblock it. And without a parent, they can't have it unblocked.
Well, Dr. Burtman, you just mentioned something that parents might see as a problem for them, which is that kids will come to you and to the library to use a site that, although not at all pornographic, to some parents, it's not information they want their kids to share with a stranger on a computer, they want them to come to them.
Right, and I certainly appreciate that. But as a practicing family physician in Rhode Island, I see this issue all the time. And the bottom line is, parents may wish that, but children are out there learning and exploring on their own, and I think they need access to helpful and real information from physicians rather than just bury their head in the sand and hope that the child doesn't get in trouble.
What do you think about the other separate issue, which is, you know, kids who go to the library and either stumble on or are using the computers to look for pornography?
Pornography is a difficult issue, and I have two young children. I certainly don't want them surfing the net for porn. But I think we as parents need to make that decision on our own, and if we don't feel our child is trustworthy enough to be at a library without our supervision, then we shouldn't allow it. And the bottom line is, if someone pulls up Playboy.com, I don't think they're going to be scarred for life. I think that they're learning about themselves and they're exploring. They're learning how to take good information from the net and wean out the junk.
But as you know, there's far worse than Playboy.com.
And interestingly, this blocking software really may not block all of it. So despite blocking my reputable site, it may end up actually failing to block a number of really scary sites.
Yeah, because they are finding ways to get around the filter, which looks for very specific words.
I mean, if the software was better and you could filter 99.9% of the obscene sites, which brings up a whole other definition of what that is, and not block any of the legitimate sites, I would be on the other side of this argument. But the filter is nowhere near that and can't be anywhere near that.
Well, Dr. Burtman, thank you.
My pleasure.
Dr. John Burtman spoke to us from Hope Valley, Rhode Island, about his website, afraidtoask.com.
You're listening to Here and Now. Pascal's Restaurant in Atlanta, Georgia, is much more than a place to get authentic Southern fried chicken. It's also a cultural landmark and an endangered one. Opened as a 30-seat luncheonette in 1947, there are now three Pascal's restaurants in the Atlanta area, but it's the original that was frequented by some of the giants of the civil rights movement, including Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph David Abernathy. Now the Pascal family and neighborhood activists are fighting to keep the restaurant from being converted into a dormitory for students at Clark Atlanta University. Well, joining us on the line to explain further is Kurt Pascal himself, Chief Executive Officer of the Pascal's Restaurant Group. Kurt, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, sir.
Well, first, Kurt, a little history. How did Pascal become such a meeting place for so many icons of the civil rights movement?
It was the proximity to the Atlanta University Center. You had politicians, clergy, academicians. That was always the place for everybody to come and eat on the break or at lunch or to hold conversations or symposiums or discussions.
Hmm. You must have some great pictures on the wall. Any particular memories stand out?
Well, essentially, the March on Washington was planned by Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy and Andy Young, and everybody who participated was planned right in the very front room at Pascal's. And we look back to these gentlemen as our mentors and our leaders, and the building being there embodies them, and it's a symbol to us.
Now, Clark Atlanta University owns the original Pascal's. How did that happen?
Well, it was sold about 5 years ago. Mr. Robert Pascal had passed on, and his brother at the time decided that he might want to try his hand at retirement. And I think that he found out that fishing wasn't as exciting as everybody tried to explain to him.
Oh, I see. Okay. A bit ironic that a university's in control of a place with such an historic background, a place that could, in effect, teach students about the civil rights movement, yet they're looking to knock it down. Have you spoken to university officials? Where does this all stand?
I haven't personally spoken to them. They're currently using the facility as a dormitory.
Oh.
But believe it or not, the restaurant is still operating. What they've decided is that they rather use the physical property to build a larger dormitory and parking in the area. What they want to do is essentially tear down the building and start over.
Now, there's a petition drive underway. How's it going to save Pascal's?
It's going rather well. There are actually several petition drives going on, and we certainly plan to present that to Atlanta City Council and to the Board of Regents at Clark Atlanta University.
What's your sense of the university's feelings about all this? I mean, petition drive, they must be sensitive to the history here. What's your sense of how this is going to turn out?
I think that from the university's point of view, it's a matter of logistic necessity being in conflict with conscience. You know, it's kind of, gee, we need to do this thing, but we really don't want to do it. Where do we go from here?
When will you know whether you're going to save Paschal's or not?
I don't know. This whole issue might be tabled, but by the same token, I think essentially what the university is hoping for, and I think that maybe city administration, certainly there's been some talk about this, they might be interested in a land swap for some municipal property that is not being used, some property that's owned by the city. It's very possible that the city will offer them that property in exchange for the physical hotel and then preserve it as a historical site. Hopefully, they'll still run the restaurant as well.
Kurt, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Thank you, sir.
Kurt Paschal is CEO of Paschal's Restaurant Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
At about, 8 a.m., I start thinking about lunch, especially at this time of year when the veggies are coming up. Well, lucky producer April Peavy recently went to the home of Here and Now's chef Kathy Guntz to pick the fixings for an herb salad right from Kathy's garden.
The calendar tells me it's summer, but wow, in New England here, it has been a miserable spring. We have had rain and rain and rain. And despite this weather, it is salad season. This is the time of year when we want to start eating lighter, thinking lighter, looking lighter, and we really turn to salads as the food of early summer. So I thought we could really talk about different types of lettuce and different types of herbs, but the thing that no one seems to understand is, how do you make a salad dressing? You make a salad dressing with a few very simple ingredients, and it starts with some fresh herbs. So I'm out here in my garden. I've got all kinds of things growing. Chives are beautiful. They're the first herb of the summer, and I'm going to take my kitchen scissor and snip a few off. I've got some thyme here, some beautiful lemon thyme, and a fresh variety of garden thyme. I'm going to snip that into my bowl. There's a bit of rosemary growing here. It's early, so it's still young. Some fresh basil, always a winner in salads. And then I've got a whole variety of baby lettuces growing here. I've got green leaf and a red leaf lettuce. I've got a tender bib one. And they're all very young right now. All this rain has fed them, but there hasn't been a lot of heat and sun, so they're little. But I have to tell you that baby lettuces have more flavor than just about anything. So I'm going to snip a few of those for our salad. Also got some gorgeous sage, which winters over. This is a perennial, so it's quite tall right now with these spectacular edible purple flowers. The last thing I have here are scallions, which are baby onions that are growing up, and I'm just going to grab a few of those because they're delicious chopped into a vinaigrette. Okay, ready to go in and start our salad. We're back in the kitchen. It smells wonderful with all these fresh herbs. Now, the basic salad dressing is called a vinaigrette. This is a French dressing. And this is the most simple type of dressing you can make. And as far as I'm concerned, there is no salad dressing that's better than this. Okay, step number one, a teaspoon of Dijon mustard. I'm just going to put that in the bottom of the bowl. A bit of salt or sea salt. And a grinding of good pepper. Now we're going to take some of those fresh herbs that we picked from the garden or find them at a farmer's market. I'm going to chop some of the chives, a little bit of the sage. As I said, I'm going to save some of those whole leaves for the salad and these beautiful purple flowers, our fresh thyme, and some of our fresh rosemary, which does need to be peeled right off of the stem. And we're going to chop those up and our fresh basil leaves, my favorite in a salad. I've got a good tablespoon, a little bit more of fresh herbs here. There's no right or wrong amount of the herbs. I'm going to throw all those into my mustard and salt and pepper at the bottom of the bowl. Okay, give that a good stir. That's the base of your vinaigrette, the herbs, the salt, the pepper, and the mustard. Now, the vinegar. You can use balsamic vinegar, which is very popular, but I prefer to use a white or a red wine vinegar. You want it to have a fairly good acidity, about 6%. And the general formula for vinaigrettes is 1 to 3. 1 tablespoon of vinegar to 3 tablespoons of olive oil. So depending on how large your salad is, I'm going to add 2 tablespoons of vinegar. And I'm going to stir that right into the mustard, and it's going to start to thicken. That's what the mustard does. Not only does it add flavor, but it gives the vinaigrette a really nice creamy consistency. So I added 2 tablespoons of red wine vinegar, so I'm going to add 2 times 3, 6 tablespoons of olive oil. 1, 2, you can loosely measure 3, 4, 5, 6. Now, you can whisk this together, but you don't really need to get fancy. You can just use your spoon. Give it a really vigorous stir, and what will happen is that it will start to come together. And then you're going to think, well, how do you know if it's right? How do you know if you've added enough oil or enough vinegar? It's just too hard to tell. Well, you taste it. Those herbs. This vinegar is quite strong because it's coming across too much, so I'm going to add another tablespoon, maybe 2, of olive oil. You want the vinegar to be there, but you don't want it to make you wince. Let's give that a try. That's just right now. That is it. That's what a vinaigrette is. This is an herb vinaigrette. This is a recipe that has 10,000 variations, and everything is right, and there is nothing wrong. I could crumble blue cheese into this and mash it up, and we'd have a blue cheese dressing. I could add fresh ginger and a touch of soy sauce, and it would suddenly be an Asian-flavored vinaigrette, and it would be terrific with different steamed vegetables or Asian-flavored ingredients. I could add a touch of milk or cream, and the vinaigrette would suddenly be a creamy, kind of milky, whole different vinaigrette. It takes on a whole different thing with a touch of cream and milk, and you only need a little bit, and that adds a fabulous texture to it. The other thing that I can do, and I'm going to do because they were fresh in the garden, is I'm going to chop a scallion into this. This is the part that I call building a salad. We've got our basic vinaigrette. We're going to add a little bit of scallion to it. It's going to add a hint of an onion flavor, and it's also going to add a good crunchy, crispy texture to the salad. And then we'll start layering on our lettuces. Okay. Now, you don't need to just use regular lettuces. You could use baby arugula leaves and baby spinach, watercress, mosh. The list of types of lettuces that are now available is long. Try them all. You want to balance bitter-tasting lettuces with sweet, buttery lettuces. It's texture and flavor, and this is what I call building a salad. So we're going to take our lettuce. I've got some of this beautiful green leaf lettuce and some butter crunch. And I also have some romaine, and I'm going to just use my hands to put it into bite-sized pieces, and I'm putting it directly on top of the vinaigrette in the bowl. I'm going to add some herbs from the garden, whole leaves of sage. Just snip it right off of the stem, and throw it in whole, what this is going to do is it's going to add another texture and another flavor. I'm going to take some of these sage flowers, these purple flowers. Those are beautiful added to a summer salad bowl. Now, our salad's ready. It's best served now, right after you've picked it and cleaned it and washed it. But you can keep this in the refrigerator for a few hours. Do not toss it until you're ready to serve it. So I'm just going to toss my salad. The vinaigrette's right in the bottom, so it couldn't be easier. You don't want to overdress a salad. I only made enough vinaigrette for about a head and a half of lettuce, because you don't want it to drown. If it looks like you've got too much vinaigrette there, that it's going to really drown the lettuce leaves, take some out and keep it to the side. You can always add more, because there is nothing worse. The whole idea of a vinaigrette is that it's a very light coating. And that's just what we've got here. I am smelling sage and rosemary and basil and these crisp lettuces and the chives and, ooh, the scallion is coming through. And it's just a song to summer of green and freshness. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate the coming of the summer season than with a beautiful garden salad.
Such poetry. Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunt's recipe for herb salad is on our website, here-now.org. Is a production of WBUR Boston.
And just before we go, this reminder, we always love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And for more information on the show, visit our website, here-now.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks.